Welcome back to the program. There's an apocryphal story about the state of education which tells of a man who falls asleep a la Rip Van Winkle about 100 years ago. He wakes up today and is totally disoriented. Everything is new and different: transportation, technology, design, fashion, entertainment. Then he stumbles into a 21st century classroom, and suddenly he feels calm and at home because so little has changed. Some would argue that this is part of the problem of education today. Others would argue for the value of those fundamentals, that we've long had many of the right ideas, but just need to execute them in a much better way. This is where we join the conversation about education with my guest, David Kerp. David is a nationally known education expert. He's the James D. Marver Professor of Public Policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of 17 previous books and scores of articles in newspapers and magazines, and it is my pleasure to welcome David Kerp back to this program to talk about his latest work, Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. David Kerp, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. This story, this book, takes place in Union City, New Jersey, a place where 90-plus percentage of the kids are on free and reduced lunch. A Latino community, not some place you would necessarily expect to find advances in education. Talk a little bit about it.
Well, it really is the most unlikely site for education reform. It's a very poor town. The unemployment rate is about 1.5 times the national average. It's jam-packed with folks. There are a lot of apartments in which you've got 3 and 4 families jammed together in one apartment. The guess is that about a third of the people who live there are undocumented, so they're always looking over their shoulder to see whether ICE, the Immigration Service, is going to come and take them home and split up families. So it is, as you say, a very unlikely place to have education reform. And indeed, 25 years ago, the schools in Union City were so bad that the state was about to take them over.
How did you wind up beginning to look at this place?
I visited Union City first when I was writing a book about preschool and about other supports for kids, a book called Kids First. And I'd heard about the Union City preschools, and they were, as advertised, amazing places. Really, really gardens of earthly delights. The kind of place where you kind of wish you were 4 years old again. And I was really impressed. And I was, the preschool that I visited was located near a K through 8 school. And I thought, what the heck? Let me go visit the other classrooms, because the school district's test scores were quite good. And every classroom I went into, and I was on my own, every classroom I went into, you had competent teachers, you had some very good teachers, and you had a handful of really superb teachers. But you didn't have any of those, you know, the kind of bad, loafing, you know, just by the numbers teachers that we hear so much about. These guys were really engaged, and the curriculum was not a, you know, parroting back and forth question response. Kids were working on projects, the teachers were working with groups of kids. It was an exciting place, and I wondered how on earth did Union City come up with a system as good as this one? And I decided that I'd spend the better part of a year there answering that question.
And how did they begin to improve the system? As you say, 20 years ago it was so bad the state was about to take it over. What was the turning point? What started to happen?
You know, you're asking all the right questions, because begin and start are really important parts of this conversation. This was no instant miracle. You know, you've got folks now out there saying, I've turned around the school in a year. People like Michelle Rhee, who made that claim about Washington, D.C. And, you know, the problem with those folks who promise things that are too good to be true, it's the same problem as Bernie Madoff, right? If they promise something that's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. It's got to be a slow, gradual process. And they began, Union City began, with the two basics for that community. One of them is, since you have so many kids who come to school not speaking English, 75% of those kids come to school not speaking English, do you need a finely granulated, a really carefully constructed bilingual program that gradually helps kids first become fluent in their own language, because linguists will tell you that's crucial, and then transition gradually to English. So you have classes grouped both by language ability and by academic skill level for each of the subjects. So that was one thing, really good bilingual education. The second thing is, these kids came from homes where books were not commonplace, for parents just didn't have time to read to their kids. And so the schools figured out they've got to compensate for this. So there's a very literature-rich, word-rich, writing-rich curriculum right from the start. So that's where they began, and they began at the lower grades, and they worked their way up the grades. That was the starting point in the process, and that's what was going on the early 90s. And then, time passed, they were able to add other elements to the story. The curriculum for the schools was written not by a bunch of outside experts, but by the best teachers in the district. It's the same curriculum across the district because poor kids move. 2 or 3 times a year is not uncommon. And so it's important that there be continuity for them. And as well, they developed a curriculum that was coherent from one grade to the next. I mean, I remember when I was in school, I must have read Old Man and the Sea 3 times. That doesn't happen there. There is a sense of what leads to what. And the teachers who are local, and that, by the way, is really typical. I mean, if you look at the teachers, in Napa or in, any place that you think of outside of a handful of Haydens, most of those teachers, I'm going to bet, are going to come from within 100 miles of the area. And these guys are great. They really are homebodies. Most of them grew up, went to school, came back and taught, and really have never lived more than 100 miles from where they're now teaching. So they really are talking about their kids. Those teachers get a lot of support. They get support from veteran teachers. They get support from who come into the class and work with them and teach with them. They get coaching from the outside, and the teachers collaborate. I mean, that's very important. That process of connectedness is really important. And one other element I'd flag, that is that the kids are frequently assessed so that everybody knows how well they're doing, and they can pinpoint what the weaknesses are, and they can focus help and attention on those kids. And what doesn't happen in Union City is at least as important. There aren't mass teacher firings. There aren't big school closings of, quote, failing schools. There are no charter schools in the town. There are no Teach for America teachers in the town. Now, there are great charter schools, and Teach for America can be really useful in some places, but here you have a nice, stable, solid system. Teachers stick around. They know the kids, and that works really well for them, and it works really well for other successful districts.
As this district began to turn around, as all of these changes started, was there a master plan? Was there a group of people that sat down and said, this is what we are going to do over a period of time? Or is this something that evolved internally and progressively out of some very traditional ideas?
There was, from the outset, a group of teachers and administrators in the system who really, in the 80s, had not had a chance to do good work, who came together and said, let's look out there and let's see what the best is that we can do. Not the newest, not the fanciest, not the glitziest. Let's see what's tried and true, what really works, and everything that I just described. If there are educators out there, and I'm sure they are, they're all nodding their heads. They're all saying, sure, sure, sure. We know this. We know this works. We've known this works for a good long time. Maybe not as long as Rip Van Winkle, but close. And the trick is to do it. So they knew where they wanted to go, and when additional resources became available, they added things like the great pre-K program, because New Jersey, a much, much more generous state in terms of funding schools than California, provides 2 years of high-quality preschool. Well, a lot of school districts, when that decision came down, a lot of New Jersey school districts poo-pooed it. They said, early education, preschool, that's just babysitting. Union City understood right from the get-go how important, how crucial what's happening to kids when they're 3 and 4 years old is. And they added that. And more recently, really only in the last 2 or 3 years, have they been able to turn around the high school. I mean, high schools are the toughest thing to reform, the toughest parts of the school system to change. And there again, they've had a good leader, in both cases, somebody who was a local. They didn't bring in somebody from outside, who really has introduced into that school a culture of high expectations. And that, by the way, that permeates the whole system. Everybody tells these kids over and over again, the only limit on what you can do is the limit that you choose to set for yourself. You can do fantastic things. And indeed, some of these kids wind up with full scholarships to Ivy League schools. They wind up as Gates Millennium Scholars. They win science fairs across the country. And mean, the fact that made everybody stand up and take notice about Union City, the graduation, the high school graduation rate is 90%. Now, that's about 15% higher than the national average. It's 7% higher than the average in the state of New Jersey, which is a very well-to-do suburban state. I don't know what the graduation rates are in Napa, but I'm betting that any superintendent listening to the show would say, gee, if only we had a 90% graduation rate.
Right.
And remember who these kids are. They're poor Latino kids who come from families, most of whom are immigrants, many of whom come not speaking the language, having no education themselves. So they've built this system now all the way through high school and have managed to combine high expectations with a sense of trust and respect across the system. Parents for schools, and there are great efforts to reach out to parents, connect parents to the schools. Kids for teachers, teachers for the kids, teachers for the administrators, the community for the system. And that's key. I mean, we know that from a lot of other research, that if you're looking for one thing, one element that's key to this whole process, it's a culture of trust. And you don't just say it, you got to earn it. And that also takes time.
To what extent have the families gotten involved? And to the extent that they have, how has the district enabled that to happen?
Well, that's a very important point in this story, and thank you for pointing it out. The parents are amazingly connected to the schools. It's often the lament of school administrators and teachers. The parents don't get engaged. They don't show up. And I happen to be at the school. I spent a lot of time in Lyle Elementary School, a particularly poor school, even in this poor town. It was a raining cats and dogs night. It was a month into the term. I thought, nobody's going to come to this parents' night. Well, I'm going to bet 90% of those kids had somebody, a parent, a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, a family friend there to represent them. And when those parents would go to the classroom teachers, often they would say, okay, it's your job. We're glad that you're doing this. And the teachers would say, no, we need your help. And they would show them how they could help in their education. And I could watch the light bulbs go off for parents who'd never been told that they could actually help their kids in school. And beside that, there are community liaisons in every one of those schools. These are local folks who know the community, so that if parents would come in and they would trust this person enough to say, look, we can't afford the school uniform. We need help, you know, getting on the public housing list or getting a job or getting support for a GED or a green card. The parent liaisons knew who to contact. They had that Rolodex in their heads. So the school is reaching out to parents, and the parents were connecting to the school. It was marvelous to see.
Other than the desire for success and to move out of the terrible place the district was, what other incentives were there for teachers and administrators to begin to turn this thing around? We hear so much nowadays about various market forces that provide the incentive. What was the incentive here?
You know, not only in Union City, but in a bunch of school districts that I looked at across the country that have been more successful than you'd expect, given the demographics. Districts that were bigger and littler than Union City, better funded or as well funded or badly funded, with or without unions, with or without elected school boards. In all those districts, what you found was hometown pride. You know, once it became clear to the school district that they were not doing well by their kids, and I'm thinking about Sanger, California, which is a dirt poor farm town near Fresno, or Long Beach, third biggest city in the state, or Aldine, Texas, a place that none of us had heard about, that's just outside of Houston, bigger than Washington, D.C., bigger than Boston, and all those places, people were saying, this isn't right. We have got to do better by our kids. And that seemed to me to be the powerful motivation. And then there's pride, and then when you succeed, success breeds pride, and success breeds more. This is now, Union City has bragging rights. Aldine, Long Beach, Garden Grove, Sanger, these places all have bragging rights about how good their schools are. And that's important. That really boosts the self-image of a community.
How does all of this relate to, and what's the nexus between this and the reality, like it or not, of the high-stakes testing that they have to deal with?
Well, they do an interesting dance in Union City and elsewhere, because in order to prep students for those tests, they really have to do more drilling down on very formulaic processes. How do you write, you know, a three-paragraph paper, which is what you've got to do for third grade, or a four-paragraph essay for fourth grade? There's an introduction. There's a transition sentence. These are the golden words. You know, you've got to do this, that, and the other thing. The conclusion needs to look like such. So there's all that kind of formatting that a creative teacher is not going to love. And she is going to have to figure out a way to keep students engaged by keeping some of that project-based cross-subject learning while getting students prepared for that test. Now, I'm not anti-test. I think it's important to have a sense of how well students are doing. I'm not even anti the tests in a place like New Jersey or for that matter, California. They really aren't just multiple choice fact recitation tests. They do ask kids to think. And, you know, in the third grade that I was looking at, for example, you know, there were no number problems in math. They were all word problems, which is, you know, what you really would care about in math. The problem is that we overemphasize the tests. We fetishize the tests. We narrow the curriculum. And because so much depends on these tests, not only for students but for teachers, you spawn the kind of cheating scandals that we've seen most recently in Washington, D.C., and that are bubbling up, most recently in Atlanta, and that are bubbling up in Washington, D.C. as well. You know, if you're an administrator and the superintendent tells you, you better get those test scores up or you're out of a job, and you're trying as hard as you can, but you can't produce these dramatic, wild overnight gains, you know, then I wouldn't excuse the cheating, but I understand where the cheating comes from. And that's an artifact of a system that we've built for ourselves. There's just not enough trust in educators to be professionals and to do their job. We've got the balance wrong.
How much of the focus within the school system in general in Union City and within the high schools in particular is focused on these kids going to college?
The high school has kids who, you know, basically they want to go to the Army or they want to go to community college and learn a trade on the one end, and then you've got kids who are the high flyers at the other end. And the school has really been increasingly pushing first to get these kids into college. Now you've got 75% of the kids enrolling in college. And then, you know, you've got to keep them in college because, you know, the kid that just squeaked through high school is going to have a hard time in college. So their plan, that, you know, ever higher expectations, their plan is that all the kids in the school in a couple of years will be taking the preliminary SAT exam, the exam that the kids who know they're going to four-year colleges take to prep for the SAT. That just changes the equation. That really is a way of signaling to kids and teachers alike, we expect a lot from you. You've been great. 90% high school graduation rate. That's great, but we're not done. We're not pausing. You know, we'll raise a toast and then we're going to move on and we're going to do better yet by those kids.
To what extent is this self-perpetuating, particularly among the kids, as kids see other kids graduating and being successful?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look around that school and you watch, take time, focusing on the high school for a minute, and you watch, you know, how kids respond to the success of their peers. You know, they get it. As you walk into this big, wonderful high school that was built because of the political prowess of the mayor, this great, wonderful high school, there is sitting there an athletic hall of fame with all the trophies and all that stuff. Right next to it, there is an academic hall of fame, which is bigger. Which is all the awards and all the prizes, you know, with life-size cardboard cutouts so the kids are doing really well in school. You walk along the corridors of the schools, every teacher's college and graduate credentials are displayed on the door of the room. There's a message being sent, you know, that teachers worked hard for you. They're here for you. They are well-trained teachers. They're professionals. And kids get that. When I would go into classes, you know, I saw a lot of, you know, kids can be hyper, they can need to be dialed down, but they were engaged. I never saw any of the stuff that you think you're going to find in urban schools. There was none of the pushing and shoving, none of the note passing or, you know, kids, you know, talking back or any of that. They were engaged in what was going on in the classroom. If you saw occasionally a kid with his head down on the desk, it's probably because he or she 16 years old, is stuck taking care of the entire family because all the adults are gone, and is working at McDonald's till midnight in order to support those kids. But it was remarkable. And since the book was written, and I went back to Union City and talked to folks, I've gotten a slew of very articulate emails from kids in that school. We have a little correspondence going on as to what they might do with their lives and what they've learned in the school and what they could give back to Union City. It's a very impressive thing to see. But it didn't happen overnight. It required the building of a culture that embraces everybody. The newcomers get it. The kids who show up when they're in eighth or ninth grade, speaking no English and with very, very little education in their home countries, get an incredibly rich program, which gets over half of them graduating in 4 years. Now, to put that in perspective, you take New York City, with the Latino population is much better off than in Union City. They don't have a graduation rate for all their Latino kids that's as high as the rate for kids who've just shown up within 4 years. And this year, in the graduating class of 2013, two of the top 10 students are going to be students who came from Latin America 4 years ago, speaking no English. And they've not only been successful academically, what the school system is very good at is bringing them into the community. They join clubs, they join teams, they really are connected to this. I mean, they're learning a new land, learning a new language, learning new subjects, and doing better at it than anybody in the country that I know about.
What, if anything, stands in the way of other struggling districts doing similar things?
Very simply, stability. We're a very impatient society. We want to see quick fixes. We want to see instant answers. So if you look at urban school districts, for example, the average superintendent lasts on the job fewer than 3 years. She shows up, she says, I've got the answer. She gets hired by the school board. Things don't immediately change. By the beginning of year three or the end of year two, there's a new school board election. There are insurgents saying, throw the bomb out. She's gone, or else she goes and finds another job. And I don't care how insightful or thoughtful or able or charismatic that leader is. You cannot build a school system that way. There's got to be stability. That is the one non-negotiable in this story. So the message really is for school boards and mayors and parents and the public to be willing to let the school system, to enable the school system to grow, to get better, to get ever better over time, to improve continuously. That's what's worked at Montgomery County, Maryland, where you had a revolving door superintendency, and you know, then in comes a new superintendent, and he says, here's what I'm going to do, and here's how long it's going to take, and the school board gave him a few years. Things were getting considerably better. They gave him a few more years. They loosened the reins, and now, you know, Montgomery County, Maryland, just outside of Washington, you know, one of the stars, not just for the well-off kids in that community, but for some of the poorest kids in the area. Time, patience, willingness to believe that there is no instant solution. Back to basics, by which, if you look at the things that are going on there, early education, bilingual education, a literature-rich curriculum, support for teachers, assessment and targeted help for kids, a culture of trust, that's just basic stuff. I don't think there's anybody who's listening to the show that wouldn't be saying, gosh, that makes a lot of sense. Why don't they do it? And the answer is because we don't let them. Because we pick the wrong people. We pick the folks who promise instant answers, and they don't produce them. We get disappointed. We get impatient, and we pull the plug.
David Kirp, the book is Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been great talking with you.
Thank you.